A very good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is number 07-1004. Dominguez against Paul Henley and the City of Waukegan. Mr. Newman.
Good morning. May it please the court. Eric Newman on behalf of the appellants. Mr. Dominguez seeks to place the blame for his 1990 sexual assault conviction on my client, retired police officer Paul Henley, the only person left to stand trial 17 years after the arrest and conviction. Although appellee's attorneys have called my client a bad officer, a walking due process violation, and other names, some of which were broadcast over network TV just before the trial started, Henley is proud of his 30-year distinguished career. And he should be. Henley was not a bad officer. He did his job of protecting his community, and in this case, he acted responsibly in the way that any other reasonable officer would have under the circumstances.
But Mr. Newman, let me focus you on what concerns me about your appeal, and that, in a word, is the standard of review. We are not the jury. We're not the trial court. There has been a jury trial here, and the jury has come to the conclusions that it came to. And so I think while all you say may be true, it also strikes me as a bit beside the point. We need to look at this record in the light that supports what the jury found.
Your Honor, there were three different essential claims that were submitted to the jury. There was a due process, what a so-called due process claim.
Well, it was a due process claim. The trial Judge Shader was satisfied that the due process claim was properly presented in the case, and I understand that you've challenged that on appeal, but they did, in the same line of cases like Newman against McCabe, they submitted a due process claim.
Your Honor, I would direct your attention to the Wallace opinion. If you look at the
amendment. This is not Wallace. This Court's quite familiar with Wallace, and in Wallace, there's a focus on the Fourth Amendment violation, but Newman holds, and other cases in this court have held, that a Fourth Amendment violation is not the same thing as something that happens at the trial. Indeed, the violation wasn't even complete until the trial happened. That's when the suppression comes into being, if you will.
Your Honor, Mr. Dominguez was harmed at the point that he was seized as a result of the allegedly improper identification procedure.
Well, I agree with that, except that's not the only time he was harmed. He was also harmed when evidence was suppressed at the trial.
But then the question becomes, who is responsible for the introduction of that evidence at trial? And as many cases in the circuit have also held, prosecutors prosecute. And, you know, we've cited proximate cause cases here that when a police officer is forthright with the prosecutor and the information is injected into the criminal justice system, that it's really not the police officer who should be the focus of the due process inquiry.
Right, but what was the first phrase you said, when the police officer is forthright? This jury found, and I understand you're preserving the right to object to this, but this jury found that this police officer was not forthright and that the prosecutor couldn't possibly have worked with information that he or she didn't know was there.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that. The reason is because the element instruction that was sent to the jury was in the disjunctive. The first element that the jury could find against Mr. Henley was that he conducted an improper identification procedure. For that prong of the element instruction, there was no need to find that there was any kind of Brady violation, that there was any information that was withheld. So we don't know at this point, and that's the Baldwin principle that we've cited in our reply brief. We don't know why the jury found against Mr. Henley. But it's our contention that the first element in that instruction, as a matter of law, should not have been sent to the jury, not only under the proximate cause, but also under our probable cause analysis. And we believe, if you look at the amended complaint, it's our contention that the due process clause was really nothing more than a relabeled false arrest.
Well, I know you've said that, but obviously the complaint was far in the rearview mirror by the time the pretrial order, the final pretrial order, was decided. And there's another principle that's equally important for jury verdicts, which is if there's evidence in the record to support the verdict that was reached, it doesn't matter that there might also be other ways that the jury verdict couldn't be supported. We try to support the jury verdict with respect to the role of the jury.
Well, I've covered the due process claim to a certain extent, and I would also direct the court's attention to footnote 7 of the Heck opinion and the Wallace versus Cato opinion.
Yeah, I just don't see those as being pertinent to the Brady claim, which you yourself in your reply
said. Well,
and
then I'd shift to the Brady claim and say that there were two aspects of that. The first was that was submitted to the jury was the idea of fabricating police reports. I would simply say that there's no evidence in the record that Henley ever fabricated any police reports. Then the second element, that he withheld material exculpatory evidence. There were 8 principal categories of, quote, withheld evidence that was submitted to the jury. One of those was Henley was accused of having tampered with the rape kit. That was absolutely false. If you look at the chain of custody for the rape kit, the rape kit was taken by the Navy doctor. It was given to Henley in a sealed condition, and the very doctor who took the rape kit held it up in front of the criminal trial. You can see it from the transcript. They claim that the vaginal swabs and the rectal swabs were taken out of the kit, and they speculate that Henley did that. But the doctor who took the rape kit held them up in front of the criminal trial court. It's reflected in the record. Everything that they say was withheld is based on speculation. First of all, they said any reasonable officer under the circumstances would have gone back and interviewed the security guard at the apartment complex.
You said a lot of these things in your brief, and what concerns me is then when I pick up the red brief and I find out what was in front of the jury, which was a little bit hard to see, from your brief, it turns out there is testimony from Krauss. There's testimony from other people that support the finding of the jury that evidence was suppressed, that information was not passed along.
The only testimony that goes to that is, if you're referring to the identification procedure and the allegation that Henley and Moran somehow
set it up, yeah.
Set this up, and everybody was supposed to show up at the same time, and she identified him. Krauss was adamant at trial that there was no setup, that she was never told ahead of time that Dominguez was going to be there. There was reference back to her deposition testimony, and if you look at that, she was confused at her deposition and said that she had a meeting with plaintiff's counsel before that and that they put a lot of ideas into her head. The district court judge in this case said that he considered reporting Krauss to the U.S. attorney because of the inconsistencies in her testimony. Their whole trial is based on disbelieving Krauss. Disbelieving that Krauss properly identified Dominguez.
Well, she didn't properly identify him, of course, as we now know, but that's maybe not here or there.
It's a very slender reed to hold a $9.5 million judgment against my client.
Well, which Waukegan is going to pay, thanks to the district court's order after the trial was over.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I would submit with respect to, we also cited, in consistent with the Baldwin principle in Wilmington and Ratner, we've shown that there were a series of different theories under the Brady claim that were submitted to the jury. Under Wilmington, when 3 out of 8 negligence theories that were submitted were held to not have proper evidentiary support because of the general verdict, the court held that the case had to be reversed and remanded. The same thing in Ratner. 1 out of 6 fraud theories that were submitted to the jury were held not to have been supported by evidence, and there had to be a reversal and a remand. In this case, as I was referring to before, many of the arguments that were made to the jury about things that Henley must have done were based on nothing more than speculation. He must have interviewed Steve Sharp, even though Henley denied interviewing Steve Sharp, and there's no evidence that he did that. Plaintiff has a series of speculative conjectures. First of all, he must have interviewed him. Since he must have interviewed him, he must have written up a police report. Since he must have written a police report, that must have been withheld.
I think there's more to this record than you're saying. I really do think that, you know, some of the things that he claimed he'd never seen, it turned out from microfiche evidence he had seen, that the jury was entitled not to believe Mr. Henley's account. Juries aren't required to believe what somebody says.
I understand that, Your Honor, but for the reasons that I've laid out as far as the due process claim, I don't think should have been submitted to the jury as a matter of law. I've pointed to problems with the Brady claim. There were also other problems with the trial that I think impacted my client. One of those was the jury instructions. The judge refused to enter a jury instruction that said that Henley could only be personally responsible for his own constitutional violations.
I thought the judge found that, in a sense, that was already covered, and also there was a problem with the timing of when you were asking the judge to put that instruction in, that they were done with the instruction conference at that point.
No, that's not correct with this instruction, Your Honor. There was a lot of debate during the jury instruction conference, and on that particular instruction, the judge did believe that it was incorporated into the element instruction. But
right.
If we're talking about the possibility of juror confusion, all we have to do is look at the first note that came back from the jury. They said, if we believe that if we get to the point of assessing damages, are we limited to assessing damages against Henley for his own acts, or can we assess damages against him for all of the wrongs that were committed?
But that's a perfectly I don't know that that shows, you know, as you well know, liability can exist and you can be jointly and severally liable for an entire course of conduct. I don't know that that shows that they were misunderstanding that. And it certainly doesn't suggest to me that the instruction that you were presenting would have changed anything. We look at instructions as a whole. We don't look at instructions one at a time.
It's a Seventh Circuit pattern instruction,
yeah.
And I think
it doesn't
under the
necessarily
circumstances,
mean it has to have been given, though.
Okay. As far as other problems with the trial, Your Honor, there was the so-called Chancy memo, which was absolutely devastating to my client. But what was the Chancy memo really based on? It was, first of all, a wholly unrelated incident. It was based on nothing more than rumors and innuendos, as the memo itself says, that was under investigation. Plaintiff's counsel never fulfilled his promise of tying it up. There was no foundation for it.
Yeah, district court give a cautionary instruction with respect to the admission of that evidence?
There was no cautionary instruction.
The one ever asked for?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I don't believe so. But
I thought your opponent said that at the time that memo came in, the Monell claim was still in the case and that it was pertinent to the Monell part of the case.
That is what he claimed, but I would direct your attention to the Carter opinion that we've cited, which is directly on point here. And in that opinion, Justice Bork said that even when there's a Monell claim, to just simply open up a police officer's personnel file and to start admitting items from the personnel file into evidence is exactly what 404B is supposed to prevent, and it's also more prejudicial than probative. I mean, they showed this memo, they projected it up on a screen, and with every witness they possibly could, including witnesses who had never seen it before, who had no knowledge of the circumstances, asked questions of those witnesses. And I think that was prejudicial and unfair to my client. There should have been some type of basis that was established before this memo was used.
You're into your rebuttal, you know, sir.
If you have any further questions at this time, I'd be happy to answer them, but otherwise I'd save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Newman.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Lowe.
Thank you, Your Honor. John Lovey, may it please the Court. There was a jury trial, and many of the issues that were raised there were presented to the jury, and that they took their best shot at convincing a jury that they didn't proximately cause injuries, and the jury agreed with us. And jury verdicts under our system of justice are afforded a substantial amount of deference, and nothing presented here justifies departing from that principle.
So what's your response to Mr. Newman's, what he calls his Baldwin point, that the jury might have rendered its decision on impermissible ground?
Well, that obviously was raised in the reply, so we didn't address it in our brief, so I appreciate the opportunity to address that. We took a look at Seventh Circuit case law. We found a case called Cosman, 211 F3rd, 1031, that says the exact opposite, that says what Your Honor is saying, which is we try to keep jury verdicts, and if we can find a sufficient way to sustain the jury verdict, then that's enough. And I'll actually, you know, it's unusual to do it in oral argument, but because we didn't get any opportunity in writing, I'd like to actually turn to the language of that case. This is at page 1037. The language was, because the defendant never requested any special forms of verdict, they only returned a general verdict. And when a jury only returns a general verdict, we need only find support in the record for one of the theories presented to the jury in order to affirm the award. And that's the end of it. And that is a principle of law that this circuit has recognized. We found a case called Cully, 862 F. 2nd, 119. And that case cites the composite marine.
Did you notify your opponent of these cases that you discovered?
We did not, Your Honor.
Well, you know we have a rule that provides for you to be able to do that.
Then I apologize to both my opponent and the court. Not as an excuse.
Well, you knew that, and Judge Ripple's permission, we'll give him an opportunity to respond to him.
That sounds fair and appropriate, Your Honor. And, you know, it came up in their reply, which is why I went and found the cases, but I do apologize.
You can file a memorandum within 10 days with respect to these cases, and then we'll give the appellants 10 days to reply to that memorandum.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. But the principle of law is sound, because they're the ones that want to preserve error. They can't say, well, we agreed to a jury instruction that was a disjunctive. In other words, both sides came in and said, we will submit to the jury instruction where plaintiff can win under any or all of three liability theories. And then new counsel comes in on appeal and says, well, we got a problem with one or more of those, so that taints the whole jury verdict. That's not an appropriate strategy. And, of course, this is an academic debate, because they haven't poked the slightest hole in any of the bases for the jury verdict. We won them all, and they haven't found error in them all. So this court needn't even reach the question of whether you can sustain it on one claim or the other. Starting with the Brady claim, they conceded in their brief, Your Honor is correct, that they are not challenging the timeliness of the Brady claim. They further conceded on page 11. They are not suggesting there's qualified immunity for a Brady violation, and that's, of course, appropriate because that's what this court has held. So they're left with their sufficiency of the evidence challenge to the Brady claim, which they didn't raise in a Rule 50 motion, which is really the end of it, and which is not a valid challenge. There was plenty of evidence in the record, and we feel strongly that the record was not presented properly by the appellants, and they left huge swaths of the record out, and that plenty of evidence was withheld. They're really seizing on one argument. They're saying, well, the rape kit argument, we got the better of that one. But, you know, there was not a special interrogatory to this jury. We made a lot of arguments about things that were withheld, and the jury agreed with us. And there is an amply sufficient basis for that verdict. And when they want to say on the physical evidence that there's no evidence that Henley withheld this, the fact is, what he cited to Your Honors when he said, oh, the doctor said at the criminal trial, here's the evidence, that wasn't in the trial record. And you could see from some of the emotion in our brief that we found that an illegitimate strategy, that they cited in their appeal brief parts of the criminal transcript that the district court told them five times were not part of the trial record. And they just went ahead and cited it anyways. And
so your point is simply that the jury never heard that that's what the doctor said in the criminal trial, not that it isn't somehow part of the criminal transcript or that eventually that transcript wound up here.
Exactly, Your Honor. And they may be right about that one particular argument, but the point is it's not fair to say we got reasons that the jury never heard, that we, the attorneys, never presented to the jury. And the fair play argument was you can't tell from reading their brief that they never presented that. And, in fact, in their reply they say it's absurd that we would question this. Well, they tried very hard in the district court to argue that that was part of the trial record, and the district court disagreed with them five times, and they went ahead and did it anyways. But again, that's a peripheral point. The real point is we have plenty of support for the sufficiency of the evidence, and they didn't make a Rule 50 motion anyways. You know, they want to say, well, Krauss has changed her testimony. Let's look what really happened. She gave a deposition, and she said this was a setup. Then came trial, and she met with not those attorneys, but the trial attorneys, and she said, you know what, I'm changing my mind. It wasn't a setup. And yes, she was impeached with her prior statements under oath saying it was a total setup. And she said, well, I'm not saying that anymore. That's when Judge Shader, the district court, said, well, now we got a problem here, because she said under oath that it was a setup, and then she's inexplicably changing her testimony after meeting with the trial attorneys. That did trouble Judge Shader. But, of course, the only real point is the jury had to decide which sworn statements to believe, the statements at the deposition or her disavowal at trial. And it was certainly within the jury's prerogative to believe that the first thing she said under oath was, in fact, the truth. And that supports the verdict independently. That's the end of this appeal. So the Brady claim was sufficient. They have no real challenges. The improper, the fabrication of false evidence equally supports this verdict. On the Jones case, this court held that false police reports can, if it's unknown to the criminal defense attorney and to the court, that can support a due process violation under NAPU and Supreme Court principles. And in this case, Henley created police reports making it seem like it was a spontaneous identification, and the jury was within its province to find that that was false evidence. The faulty ID also, you know, they ignored it. And let's be, you know, candid. Neither of their brief really talks about that claim. They tried to pretend it wasn't even there in their statement of facts. But this court has long recognized, and so has the Supreme Court, that when you cause a faulty identification to be used against a criminal defendant at trial, that that violates the 14th Amendment, and with good reason. It is not only a Fourth Amendment violation. In fact, as Judge Wood pointed out, it wasn't even a violation until it got used against them at trial. He couldn't have sued under Alexander and Hensley and this court's precedents. If he had tried to bring a lawsuit saying, I got falsely arrested because they manipulated a witness, he would have been out of court, because it's not a violation. It protects core rights, not prophylactic rights. It is not a violation unless and until it got used against him at trial, which under Heck kicks in Heck. And, you know, they argue in their brief, well, that means police officers have to come back years after the fact. That's the principle of Heck. It's a choice between two evils. We could have all these lawsuits brought at the beginning, but the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia, speaking for unanimous court, said, no, we'd rather have you wait until you invalidate your conviction. And that's what happened here. So we've obviously, they've poked no holes in that claim either. They waited till after trial to raise a qualified immunity, and at that point they are stuck with the jury's finding that they intentionally manipulated a witness identification. So as I said, the academic debate about whether the verdict can be upheld for any basis is beside the point, because they've raised no valid appeal arguments with respect to any of the bases.
Well, what about the prejudicial impact? It does seem to me this Chancy memo was pretty powerful stuff. What about the prejudicial impact as sort of tainting the trial as a whole?
Well, although it wasn't listed in their appendix as the rule requires, the fact is the district court ruled on this five or six times, and the district court's ruling was you didn't object in the pretrial order. And that's the rule. The Northern District has enacted a standing order. If you got objections, you make them before the trial in the pretrial order, because we're not going to have a trial where it's messy and, you know, people object. If you waive your objection.
So you listed it in the pretrial order,
right,
something you were going to use. They didn't say, we object because this is going to be highly prejudicial,
exactly,
to our client.
Nor did they even move in limine or raise any objection. So the basis of the district court's discretionary decision, in which this court would have to say was an abuse of discretion, was you didn't object in the pretrial order. There's a standing order that says if you got an objection to evidence, you raise in the pretrial order. That's the end of it. But we got other real good arguments, including the fact that when we put it on the screen, as they said, they didn't object. And we carefully annotated the record. We walked Chancy through it. Why did you, you know, why did you enact these restrictions? Because it was relevant to the Monell claim at the time. Why, what, where, and they didn't object to any of it. In fact, we, you know, all the sites are right there in their brief. Four witnesses went and were going through it without objections. They made a strategic choice. You know, they obviously would have paid a price if they objected and looked like they were hiding it, but they decided they weren't going to be afraid of it. That was their strategic choice. Then the trial is almost over, and then they say, you know what, we better start thinking about appeal issues. At that point, they objected to the Chancy memo. But you can't. And not only did they not object in the first instance, but they themselves referred to it. They walked witnesses through it, too. They tried to own it. And it was only after it was pretty clear that that was a bad strategic decision that they tried to turn it into an appeal issue. They didn't ask for a cautionary instruction. maybe because the evidence that it was relevant to the Monell, you know, it was clearly relevant to the Monell claim because the state's attorney decided that this guy was a sufficient amount of a problem for criminal defendants that they were enacting restrictions. You know, the Chancy memo says, if Henley says that a witness is saying it, don't believe him because we've had problems. And we got the state's attorney to admit on the stand, we don't do that every time there's one problem. This is obviously the result of a compilation of problems. And when the state's attorney tried to enact these prophylactic problems to protect against abuses by Detective Henley, Waukegan complained. And we did tie it up. And when Waukegan complained, the state's attorney removed the restrictions, and then what happened to my client happened. So that's clearly relevant to the Monell claim. We lost the Monell claim, and that got directed out. But it was an error to have brought it in. Nor, once they won the Monell claim, they probably could have come up with a cautionary instruction, you know, this was relevant to something that's not in. But the reason that that cautionary instruction wouldn't have been given was because it was relevant to the trial. It's a 404B analysis. And again,
and what factors under 404B are you arguing?
Opportunity, knowledge, absence of mistake. This is the kind of discretionary determination that trial courts make all the time. And Judge Shader made the determination. It's not in their appendix, but he said, I'm considering the factors, and I'm exercising my discretion that this is proper 404B evidence. So I don't even agree with their threshold premise that, you know, that there's so much prejudice here that it automatically outweighs the probative value, because it's very probative. But the fact is, they've waived, by their strategic choices, they've waived it in many different directions. Nor is this the kind, even if we assumed it was error, this is not the kind of thing that you could overturn an 1,800-page transcript trial. This is one piece of evidence among many. They didn't object to it in the pretrial order. They didn't object to it at trial. They didn't ask for a cautionary instruction. It was relevant to the issues in the case. That's not the kind of thing that you're going to get a new trial for. Another argument that they raised was, you know, they want to hide behind the prosecutors. They're saying, they cite cases properly holding that when police are forthright with prosecutors, then that's a different situation than when they're not forthright. And every claim in our case was exactly that they were not forthright. And this court has had an opportunity to address that scenario. In Newsom, this court eloquently said, look, prosecutors prosecute, but when police are not forthright with the prosecutors, then the pressure's got to bear on a different locus. It's really a powerful point, is that prosecutors have immunity, and if police officers mislead prosecutors, then the system's going to have a problem unless you can create liability. And that doesn't mean we win. That means we get to go to a jury, and we get to argue to a jury that this police officer warped and distorted the criminal process, and that's what the jury found. The jury found, by an agreed jury instruction, that he intentionally withheld evidence and manipulated a witness identification in such a way that no fair trial could be possible. And they've identified no reason to disturb that jury determination, and certainly the fact that a prosecutor prosecuted isn't going to change it. Ultimately, their argument is a proximate cause argument. They're saying, we didn't cause it because the prosecutor caused it. That's an argument that could have been and was made to the jury. The jury decided it and said, no, Sergeant Henley proximately caused the injury. You know, they raised the jury question, that the jury was thinking along those lines, and the district court properly told the jury, only find liability if you believe that Henley was the causative, you know, source of the problem. And the properly
instructed... Do you happen to remember which instruction?
It was in response to the jury question.
The jury question about the liability?
Exactly. Okay. When they came back, the judge's answer was something, was an explanation of proximate cause. And obviously causation was built into the agreed issues instruction. They could only find, for us, if they found that Henley created a situation where no fair trial could take place. So that agreed instruction is the end of it. And, the instruction that they take issue with, 702, we clearly have the better of that argument as well. The agreed instruction had only one actor. Henley had to have done X, Y, and Z. And then the district court, when he read the jury instruction, said, we are focused on Henley. So the additional instruction that they want to give is purely redundant. And the district court explained that when you create redundancy, it creates problems. And the source of 7.02, and the reason it's an agreed pattern instruction, is when you have more than one defendant. That's when that instruction is appropriate. That's what the district court explained. In this case, there was only one defendant, and the liability instructions were very clear. You can only find for us if you find that Henley did these things. And this was a point at trial, and their attorney did say, don't find us liable for things other people did, and we certainly didn't say anything counter, but the jury resolves factual questions, and the jury here said, we think Henley did it by their general verdict. So when you view the instructions as a whole, the fact that this was an agreed instruction goes a long way. You know, they agreed to instructing the jury in such a way that if they found for us on any of these claims that that would be sufficient for liability. This court has long enunciated a principle that you can't challenge a jury instruction of which you were the proponent. We won all three claims going away. They really haven't poked any holes in any of them. The qualified immunity argument that they've raised after trial, after the jury's already found that he intentionally violated their rights, really is just a causation argument that was already presented to the jury. The only other point I'd like to raise, although it didn't come up in their argument, the idea that the improper identification claim was untimely is simply wrong as a matter of law. The claim didn't arise until the trial happened. When he was falsely arrested, the claim had not accrued. Wallace did not overturn Heck. In fact, Wallace affirmed Heck. Wallace said the Heck rule still has principle, but it's not going to apply to a Fourth Amendment claim. We heeded that, and we dropped our Fourth Amendment claim. Their argument really is, you know, if you've been falsely arrested, that's the only constitutional violation that could possibly apply. And we have the person who was involved in Wallace in the room here, and we don't read Wallace that way. That is not a proper interpretation of that case. You can have something that violates the Fourth Amendment and violate other amendments. The most obvious example is if you coerce a confession out of somebody with force. That violates the Fourth Amendment because it's excessive force. But then, later on down the road, if that coerced confession gets used against you, it violates your Fifth Amendment right to self-incrimination. They want to read this court's Wallace opinion and say, no, if it's a Fourth Amendment violation, that's all it could ever be. And that can't be what the law is, because the framers didn't stop at the Fourth Amendment. They kept going. There are other amendments, and here those amendments were implicated. The jury was instructed to find if Henley violated them, we should win, and we did. And they have identified no reason to disturb the jury's verdict. If there are no further questions, I will release the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Lovey.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Newman have? Thank you.
I'd like to address a couple of those points. First of all, with the Chancy memo, the record speaks for itself. But I'll identify some pages for you where defense counsel specifically objected to the use of the Chancy memo. Pages 307 through 310 of the trial transcript, page 336, page 450 through 452. And I'm glad you brought up the idea of a limiting instruction, because the improper use of the Chancy memo was talked about during the jury instruction conference at page 1575. It was objected to, and the judge said that it was proper under 403 and 404B.
You asked for a limiting instruction.
I know that it was discussed, and I don't think a specific limiting instruction was tendered, but they did raise it as error with the district court judge. With respect to the Brady claim, there's two aspects of the Brady claim that have not been touched on yet, and one is materiality. You have to show that there's a reasonable probability that the evidence that was allegedly withheld would have made a difference. The evidence that they talk about here would not have made a difference in the trial. The eight specific types of Brady violations that he outlined in his closing arguments, none of those would have made a difference at trial. And then another big issue in this case that hasn't been touched on is that there's only a Brady violation if materials could not have been obtained through the reasonable diligence of the defense counsel. And that's the real story in this case. The real story is that Dominguez had a defense attorney that was asleep at the switch, never tried to suppress the identification, met for 40 minutes with a translator with this client before trial.
But wait a minute, Mr. Newman, I mean, you have made this argument, and there may be remaining problems with defense counsel, but on the other hand, when information is being suppressed, defense counsel would have no way of knowing that there was a meritorious objection to make. We don't want lawyers off there making frivolous objections based on speculation that maybe a police officer isn't saying something.
The criminal appellate attorneys that were hired on Mr. Dominguez's behalf made every single argument with respect to an allegedly improper identification procedure to the Illinois appellate court that's been made in this case. They had the information. They obtained the information. How did they do that? They looked at the very same documents that were given to Carter, the defense attorney, and they were able, from those documents, to make that argument. So,
but I don't think this tells us how, you know, you're asking us to go back and redo the Illinois criminal trial, and it seems to me the fundamental prejudice standard is, does it undermine your confidence in the verdict because these various things happened? And I think based on the facts the jury found, one's confidence in that verdict should be undermined. Doesn't matter if the lawyer was making objections or not. Mm-hmm. If evidence is being suppressed.
Your Honor, if I may spend some of my time on the Chancy memo, I'd like to talk about that. First of all, they misidentified it in the final pretrial order, not only by document number, but by title. It was completely misidentified. So they were caught off guard when they got to trial, and this memo was then being flashed up on the screen. But even despite that, defense counsel still objected to it.
Was it not possible to look at the pretrial order and find it in the submissions?
Your Honor, I never got a copy of the exhibit booklets, but it was misidentified, it was mislabeled, and defense counsel for Mr. Henley later said that they were caught off guard.
I'm wondering, were they asleep at the switch? I mean, it seems to me if you get the exhibit book, you want to take a look at the various exhibits and see if you want to object to anything.
I don't know that, Your Honor, but also with respect to the pretrial order, was unevenly enforced. When it came to plaintiff's counsel had a responsibility to put that pretrial order together, and I know the defense counsel had to cooperate, but there was no column for objections. Nobody made any objections to any exhibits, and they never disclosed their Brady claim. It was a surprise at trial. The pretrial order was enforced against us. All of their exhibits came in because of the pretrial order, but at the same time, they were allowed to surprise us with a Brady claim at trial, and I just don't think that was fair under the circumstances. If you just look at the Chancy memo in and of itself, it's so prejudicial that it impacted this trial, would have had to have impacted the trial, and all you have to do is look at the Hari, the Chancy, the witness questioning, witnesses who had absolutely no knowledge of the Chancy memo. It was paraded everywhere. It was made one of the most prominent aspects of this case. For them to say it's just one piece of paper, it's just one document, no, it was projected up on the wall, and it was used throughout the entire trial and prejudiced my client. I would say just quickly with respect to the statute of limitations he's referring to Heck, but Wallace was also a unanimous decision. It was also by Scalia, and there's the jurisdictional limbo part of the opinion, which I think is very important here. Most of the witnesses in this case were dead.
Your time has expired. I'll have to ask you to wind up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Indeed, our thanks to both Mr. Newman and to Mr. Lovey for their fine presentations.